The next case for argument is Arredondo against Hubrick. Please don't touch the microphone. Mr. Grable.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is...
He can raise the podium if he wants, though.
It's fine.
You're okay?
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bishop Brewell. I represent petitioner appellant David Arredondo in the matter before the court this morning. My client's case got here via the Eastern District of Wisconsin, where he filed a habeas petition arguing that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals had unreasonably applied the Supreme Court precedent of Rock versus Arkansas. My client is asking that this court vacate his conviction and his sentence, and at the very least, give him a new trial. The clearly established federal law set out by Rock is that when restricting the right to testify, a state must evaluate whether a restriction imposed on the right to testify is justified by the interest served by that restriction.
Let me ask you, though, what in Rock says that a trial judge is not permitted to structure the trial so that there's a time when the decision whether or not to testify is made, and there's a time when the case is closed, and so on? You see where I'm going? Because the trial judge did all of those things, and Mr. Arredondo didn't decide he wanted to testify until the 11th and a half hour, and the trial judge said, no, I just don't see where Rock is talking about that.
The trial court most certainly is able to structure the trial as it sees fit, but when it structures the trial in a manner that's going to restrict or, in this case, eliminate a defendant's right to testify, it then needs to analyze whether the way it's structuring the trial, the way that restriction that it's imposing, is in fact whether that is justified in eliminating the right to testify.
Well, you know, my problem is that although that might be a good rule and it might be a rule that the Supreme Court would adopt, you'll agree that that's certainly not the context of Rock, which is about hypnotically induced testimony and so on. And we are repeatedly told by the Supreme Court in this collateral attack area that we need to operate, the way I'll put it is we need to operate at the correct level of specificity. So even though you might derive the principle that you've articulated from Rock, maybe you don't have to derive it, and it's certainly not exactly what Rock was about. So how do we, consistently with 2254, come out your way?
I would say that this case, that Rock is basically, in the right to testify context, the equivalent of Strickland in the ineffective assistance of counsel context. It sets out a general rule of what must occur when the right to testify is being restricted, much like in when you're raising an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Strickland sets out the evaluation process that you must go through.
So does Rock, in your view, mean that the trial court has to undertake this inquiry every time the defendant pops up and says, I've reconsidered again, now I want to testify? I mean, suppose he had done it after the trial, the jury comes back and he says, I'm moving for a new trial on the ground that I've now decided that I really wish I had testified.
He says this after the jury had reached
the verdict. Yeah, after the jury verdict's in, and it's a timely motion for new trial.
But Rock, I think, makes clear that the right to testify is a trial right. So at that point, the trial would be over, and he basically couldn't then invoke.
So at least you're willing to say he can't reopen the trial at that point. What if the jury is still deliberating and he wants to come in and move to have a mistrial declared or somehow move to have the trial reopened?
I would argue that the court should then go through the analysis, and it can ultimately find at that point, well, we're in the middle, the jury is already deliberating. I realize the right to testify is important here. I've considered that, but because he's actually waited till the jury is now already deliberating, if the court had gone through that analysis, then the court could say, no, we're not going to allow you to testify.
In your view, does it make any difference how often the court has already done the analysis? Because, of course, the trial court here had been through a whole process in which your client had said, Mr. Arredondo had said he didn't want to testify, and then he changed his mind. Does he have to do it two times, three times, ten times?
In that case, I would suggest that what the court went through was a waiver analysis to see if went through a waiver colloquy to see if my client understood what he was waiving at that point. Mm-hmm. When he then later chose to invoke his right to testify, by if the court were to say, well, he waived and we're not going to consider that, that would be basically applying the sort of per se rule that Rock says you're not supposed to apply.
And I don't think there's anything in the structure of your argument about waiver that's limited to the right to testify. Suppose this has to do with the right to a trial by jury. And before the trial begins, the defendant, after an elaborate process, says, I waive my right to trial by jury. I know everything. I've been adequately informed. I consent to a bench trial. And halfway through the bench trial, the defendant says, I've changed my mind. I want a jury. Can't the judge properly say, no, it's too late to change your mind. I'm not going to give you another opportunity.
But here, Rock has nothing to do with the right to a jury. We're dealing with the right to testify.
But your argument also, as Judge Wood observed, isn't based on Rock. Rock says a defendant has a particular right. The circumstances under which that right is waived and how many times waiver has to be offered are got at separately. Right? So I'm trying to figure out whether you're applying your waiver analysis to other rights. There are all sorts of rights in the criminal process that are waived or not, asserted or waived, at a particular time. And when that time passes, the judge doesn't do it again. I'm trying to figure out why this would be a right that the judge has to revisit rather than just asking the defendant to choose, and the defendant chooses and the world moves on.
I guess our argument would be that realistically the waiver in this case doesn't really matter, because when he chooses to then invoke his right to testify, if the court wants to continue to restrict his right to testify based on the earlier waiver, it could most certainly do that, but it needs to go through an analysis to say, does this...
Why? Take my case of the jury waiver. The defendant has waived it. If later on, after the trial has moved on, he tries to unwaive the waiver, why can't the judge just say, no, it's too late, we went through that?
Because the waiver then becomes a per se rule. You've per se said, any time there's a waiver...
I'm just lost. All sorts of things in the criminal process, there is a time and a place for. Defendant pleads guilty. He doesn't get another shot. He can't unplead his guilty plea, and so on. The judge doesn't have to do the waiver analysis every time the defendant says, I've changed my mind, I want to unplead.
But I don't believe we're dealing with the waiver question here, because the waiver, if we only deal with it as a waiver, the waiver itself then acts as a per se rule. You're saying that whenever a defendant has waived, he can never invoke his right to testify in any other situation. And that's a per se rule, which the Supreme Court in Rock said you...
Is there some decision of the Supreme Court which says that after a defendant has waived a particular right in a criminal case, he has a constitutional right to change his mind?
There is a case in this particular situation, Rock, which says in any situation...
Rock is not that situation.
In any situation, including whether there's...
We've been through this. Is there some case other than Rock that establishes a constitutional right of a defendant who has waived a constitutional right to unwaive the waiver, to change his mind later?
That case does not exist. I would argue that that is unduly restricting what Rock has said.
Then we've got a problem, I think. This was, I think, where Judge Wood began under the AEDPA, which says the right has to be clearly established by the Supreme Court. And if there's no decision of the Supreme Court which says that the Constitution gives people a right to unwaive waivers, then I think there's some trouble here.
I would say that that's unduly narrowing the holding of Rock, which says, regardless of if there's a waiver or not, any time you're going to restrict the right to testify, you need to then evaluate whether that restriction is justified. And it may, in fact, be justified on the basis of waiver, but you have to consider, but you have to go through an analysis so that we don't have a per se rule. We don't have a per se rule that says, any time there's a waiver, it doesn't matter, that's the end of the story. That's a per se rule, and Rock says you can't apply a per se rule. It's an evidentiary rule. The waiver rule is an evidentiary rule in this particular case, and a per se rule has been applied. I would like to reserve what little time I have for rebuttal, if that is okay.
Certainly, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Weinstein.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Warren Weinstein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, and I represent the custodian in this case. I think Judge Wood's comment about specificity really highlights the issue in this case, because in my view what this boils down to is how specific does the holding of a Supreme Court case have to be in order for it to be clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court. And of course, as in many things in the law, it's kind of an onion skin. You can start at a very narrow holding, which would be, in this case, you can't arbitrarily restrict a defendant's right to testify by an evidentiary rule, which is in fact what the Arkansas Supreme Court did in Rock. You can also then expand that just a little bit to say, well, you can't do it by a statute either if it's arbitrary. But I think when you get beyond that, you get into a pretty gray area. I think at its broadest, what Rock stands for is that the trial court has to exercise some sort of discretion in terms of denying all or any portion of a defendant's right to testify. Now, does it say anything about when in the trial that has to happen? No. So it seems to me that the circuit court in this case, which based its reliance on refusing to allow Arredondo to testify, was justified in exercising its discretion because Arredondo had rested and there was a valid waiver during the trial. And it seems to me that that's a reasonable conclusion that a state court could make. Is it the only reasonable conclusion? No, there are others. But that one was one, and that's all the AEDPA requires in this kind
there
of
ought to be a law against unpronounceable acronyms, but that's
and we have many too many of
beyond
them.
Beyond our jurisdiction.
Beyond our power to create.
Yes. One other thing, I think, is Mr. Arredondo, in essence, I think his argument boils down to the trial court didn't consider a certain factor, in this case, what his testimony would be. But it seems to me that's an implicit concession that the trial court did, in fact, exercise discretion in this case, and it seems to me that takes it out of Rock versus Arkansas's holding, probably pretty much however broad you want to phrase that holding. There was a recent case by this court, Samuel versus Frank, that not an extensive discussion, but some little discussion about how narrow we want to look at the holdings of the Supreme Court, and I think it took kind of a middle ground. In that case, Wisconsin argued it for a rather narrow holding in the case of coercion of a witness statement, but the court said no, that's a little bit too narrow. We do have rules that are more general in application that we can derive from cases, but they do have to be traced to a Supreme Court holding. And if you do that with Rock, I think what you come up with is it's a discretionary call for the trial court. And in this case, there was clearly discretion exercised. I guess one other thing I would like to mention. Mr. Arredondo argues that the state waived any harmless error in this case, and it's true that the state did waive in the district court any harmless error by refusing to brief it. The district court chose to ignore that. Mr. Arredondo does not argue that the district court abused its discretion in doing that. And the district court, of course, has discretion to ignore a waiver. Decided the case in part on harmless error, and it seems to me that's properly before the court. Unless there are any other questions. Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Grohl?
Yes, just two quick points. First of all, even if the court goes through a harmless error analysis, it's clear harmless error did not occur here. The state had to bring in evidence from the Mashner hearing that occurred after the trial to rebut the evidence that my client said he would have offered. Secondly, I was going to submit a 38J letter about Samuel versus Frank, but since counsel has brought it up, I'd like to point out that in that opinion, Judge Posner wrote, "Law is not limited to the narrowest rule stated in a case that is consistent with the facts of the case, which is one sense of holding. It embraces legal principles, though they must be legal principles derived from the holdings of Supreme Court opinions." The legal principle here, I believe, is that when restricting the right to testify, it's not even the legal principle, it's what it says, when restricting the right to testify, the state must evaluate whether the restriction is justified.
Thank you, counsel. And Mr. Gruhl, we appreciate your willingness and that of your firm to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance you've been to the court as well as your client. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Taken under advisement.